It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's the organism that can feed you, make you crazy, take down your house, devour flesh, and save your life. Our guest is Nicholas Money. He's an expert on fungus, as in mushrooms. His book is Mr. Bloomfield's Orchard, The Mysterious World of Mushrooms, Molds, and Mycologists. Well, the Stearns have unearthed the ultimate farm stand and great low country food in South Carolina. Wine expert Joshua Wesson talks wine and personality. What a fearless cab or zany Sangiovese reveals about its maker. Then chef Jerry Traunfeld spotlights the forgotten herb, lovage, and clarinetist Richard Stoltzman reveals his other passion. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Coming in like a review.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the link between fresh-baked bread and the planet's largest living organism. Our guest is Nicholas Money, expert on fungus growth and development. Now, his book is Mr. Bloomfield's Orchard, The Mysterious World of Mushrooms, Molds, and Mycologists. Wine expert Joshua Wesson talks fearless Cabernet, pensive Rosé, and zany Sangiovese. What wines reveal about their makers? Chef and herb authority Jerry Traunfeld explains lovage, a long-forgotten flavoring. Then clarinetist Richard Stoltzman tells about his second favorite place to play. You guessed it. It's the kitchen. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They do the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Michael, Jane, I understand you've been in the South, but where? Where have you gone?
We were in South Carolina, and we headed for the coast where we met a woman selling vegetables. Have a listen.
Well, we're on Edisto Island, South Carolina, and I'm Pink Brown from Georgia Pink Fresh Vegetable.
How long have you been here?
Well, I'm a native Edistonian. I was born and raised here, but in business over 25 years.
And are vegetables pretty good on Edisto?
Oh, Edisto have the sweetest soil, so we have nice sweet vegetable.
Like what? Tell me about them.
Oh, we grow cabbages, tomatoes, sweet potatoes, new potatoes, onions, squash.
Lynn, you should see these vegetables. They're absolutely spectacular, and what's really amazing is they're spectacular year-round. There is no end to the growing season on Edisto.
This is an island, you're saying, right?
Yes, it's a coastal island off the coast of South Carolina. In fact, it's interesting in so many ways. One is that this is where the big loggerhead turtles go to lay their eggs, and so it's kind of like a turtle-friendly island, and it's also a vegetable-friendly island and a wonderful place to eat.
Well, in fact, let me just get back to the turtles for a second, because this is really amazing, partly because the turtles lay their eggs there. They are so protected that if you live near the beach on Edisto, you are required by law to close your drapes at dusk so the lights don't bother the turtles when they crawl up onto the beach.
So when, you know, you're sitting there in your house with all the curtains drawn, so you might as well go out and eat something. And so Michael and I spent a luxurious week cruising around Edisto, which, of course, it took us a full day to realize it was not pronounced Edisto Island, but Edisto. And George and Pink Vegetable Stand is famous on the island for just the greatest produce. What I have to tell you, Lynn, I mean, you know what an animal lover I am, and Michael is too. What we fell in love with was we pulled up to this, it's kind of a very funky farm. It's like down a long dirt road, and you pull into what kind of looks like a somewhat dilapidated house and produce stand. There is a big truck tire, and it was lying on the ground, and in the truck tire was this wonderful dog that curls up inside the truck tire and puts his little face like out on the rubber and sort of watches everybody go by. He was very cool, very laid back, the way everything on Edisto Island is.
Now, where did you eat?
There is one really terrific restaurant on Edisto, and in fact, the chef at this restaurant, the old Post Office Cafe, is the one who told us about George and Pink, because that's where he gets all his vegetables. The old post office is, in fact, the old post office on Edisto. It used to be, back in the 1920s, the place where all the citizens of the island used to gather when the mail arrived once a week on Saturdays. Now it's a restaurant, and he serves flounder, shrimp, and oysters to die for with grits that he cooks forever. They're the kind of creamy grits of coastal South Carolina that are way more than your average breakfast grits.
And wonderful salad. He uses Clemson blue cheese, which is made at Clemson University in the agricultural department, on the fresh George and Pink lettuces. It's really wonderful.
So he's doing essentially traditional local food there.
It is low country cuisine to die for. And if you go there during the R months. I mean, you get great oysters year around there, but if you go there during the R months, you get local oysters made into what he calls an oyster skillet, which is basically a modest size cast iron skillet filled with nothing but oysters, their juice, and a lot of butter and garlic, and you get a big loaf of crusty bread to like sop into it. It's heaven.
I think if I ever retire, I may do it in Edisto Island and just get a big rubber tire and curl up in it next to Duke the dog, and then maybe rouse myself once a day to go eat creamy grits.
Hey, thanks, guys.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gina Michael Stern's latest book in their road food series is Louie's Backyard Cookbook. Now, they talk with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I have to tell you, I am just back from that area where they were, near Edisto Island. And I have to confess, I think this may be one of the most interesting culinary areas in the entire country. It's called the Carolina and Georgia Low Country. Yeah, the markers would be Savannah and Charleston. Rice is an art form there, and the grits, remember, we're just talking cornmeal here. As Michael said, they're like eating a great pudding. The seafood, well, you've got oyster roasts, fabulous local shrimp that's sautéed with bacon and spooned over those grits. Probably overall the best fried food in the United States. And there's a lot more. Now, obviously, the Low Country is worth a trip. But if you can't hit the road right away, I have some books for you to check out. Local historian and cook John Martin Taylor's Low Country Cooking. Then Gullah Home Cooking, The Defusky Way by Sally Ann Robinson. And the now classic Charleston Receipts. Well, now they're all on the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert with a maverick streak a mile wide. He believes wine and snobism do not mix, and he's always looking for exceptional bottles for little money. Hey, Josh, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
I always wondered, are nice wines made by nice people? In so many words, does the personality of the winemaker show up in the wine?
I can't believe you're asking me this question, because I've thought about it more than once, but I've never shared it with anyone for fear that, you know, people would throw old tomatoes and various La Scala vegetables in my direction. But, I've come to the conclusion that it is absolutely true that there is a correlation between the personality of the winemaker and the personality of the wines that they make. There's no doubt about it, and I think I have the facts to prove it right here in this envelope.
So give me the evidence.
Well, what, I have to open the envelope now?
You have to open the envelope. You really
do. All right, hold on, wait. Okay, in here, the first person that comes to mind is Heidi Barrett. She's a very famous winemaker, and she's a very famous woman winemaker, and she makes one of the most famous wines in the world, Screaming Eagle. Have you ever come across it?
Oh, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the most expensive, sought-after cult Cabernet on the planet, and she's a really strong, tough, you know, devoted woman, and if you met her, you would think, I don't want to say that she's a guy, but she has a lot of the characteristics that people associate with, strong-willed men. She has the courage of her convictions. She's forceful. She's fearless. And I see I'm digging a big hole for myself here, but nonetheless, her wines reflect her personality. These wines are deep. They're rich. They're full. They're fearless. To some people's palates, they're almost too big for life itself. But I find them to be incredibly interesting to drink in the few moments that I've found very wealthy people who will open them for me, because they routinely sell for hundreds and hundreds, sometimes at auctions, $1,000 a bottle or more. And And that wine is directly connected to that woman. But on the other side of the California, you know, continuum, there is, the first woman winemaker that I met was Janet Trefethen. And she is kind to a fault, and she sets a beautiful table, and she's exquisitely refined, and she makes balanced Chardonnays at Trefethen, where she's part of that whole winemaking team. And I think that her personality and her lifestyle infuse the winemaking there, and very different from the way that Heidi Barrett makes her wines, and they're both reflections of their souls, their personalities.
What about men?
What about men? Randall Graham is a crazy guy at Bonnie Doon. He's known as the first Roan Ranger, the Antichrist of wine. He boldly goes where no one went before. He doesn't make Chardonnay. He doesn't make Cabernet. He's brilliant. He's eccentric. And his wines are exactly the same way. You can't help but open up a bottle of Cadel Solo Moscato and think about some nut trying to make Moscato d'Asti in the middle of California, and he's that nut. And he ranges all over the place. I mean, this man is so mad that he will make Sangiovese, he'll make Tempranillo, he'll make blends of grapes that you can't even spell. And he's that way in his writing, he's that way in his personality, and his hair stands straight up. He looks like Don King on a bad hair day. But his wines are brilliant and eccentric, too. A good friend of mine, Jeff Morgan, makes one of the most thoughtful rosés in California. It's all he does is rosé. It's called Sola Rosa. And, I thought the other day that this wine is a very accurate reflection of his soul. And sometimes you can come across a wine and you can tell that the winemaker wasn't picked for kickball. they had a rough childhood. They were always being bullied around, and they used wine to get back at people once they could, command a toasted barrel and a stick. But I stay away from those wines. I just like good wines, and I like interesting people and the interesting products that they end up churning out.
Well, it is an art. It would reflect it. Okay, so this comes down to show me your wine and I'll tell you who you are. Right?
Exactly. Okay. We are what we drink, or we are what we make if we're winemakers.
Thanks, Josh.
Pleasure.
Wine expert Joshua Wesson is creator of Best Sellers Wine Shops. You can find his wine advice on the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, and take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week there's a new recipe for a quick work night supper. There's tips on techniques and what to check out in the market. And best of all, it's free for the asking. So register on the site, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the mysteries of mushrooms, molds, and mycologists, the renaissance of lovage, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. From Einstein bagels and Starbucks coffee to Cheesecake Factory cheesecake, Super Target. Working to find a meal for you, breakfast through dinner. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Innocuous portobello mushrooms you had last night? Well, for us, there's supper. But for scientists, they're sidekicks in botany's longest-running sci-fi thriller. I'm talking fungus. And you don't fool with fungus, because it can sabotage your house, save your life, steal your food, make you crazy, and devour flesh. Oh, and according to our guest, without fungus, we may not be here. He is Nicholas Money, international expert on fungal growth and development. He is author of Mr. Bloomfield's Orchard, The Mysterious World of Mushrooms, Molds, and Mycologists. Nicholas Money, welcome to the show.
Oh, good to talk to you, Lynn.
So what is the significance of fungi in science?
I think it's difficult to overstate the significance of fungi in science and in our lives. Human existence would be close to inconceivable without the activities of yeast. This single-celled fungus, a thing called Saccharomyces cerevisiae by scientists. I mean, without this, there would be no baking or brewing, no bread, no wine, no beer.
So you're saying that little package that we buy in the supermarket is really, it sounds like it's miraculous.
I think it is a miraculous substance. Just, you know, you can purchase this for a few cents and add some water, and then it does such wonderful things for us.
Okay, so we have the yeast, which is one cell. What's an example of a larger fungi?
Well, some fungi are absolutely enormous. If you look in the Guinness Book of Records now at the world's largest organism, I think you'll find that it's a thing called the honey fungus or the honey mushroom. Some years ago, it was found in Michigan. Just a single one of these fungi spread over a massive area, something like 40 acres, and equaled the mass of a blue whale. And now there's an even bigger example of this that's been found in Oregon. It's estimated to be 2,000 to 3,000 years old. And it might cover as much as 2,200 acres.
Oh, my God. I'm just thinking what that would be like for dinner. So, Nicholas, what is the difference between fungi and mushrooms?
Well, a mushroom really is the sexual organ produced by a particular type of fungus, a thing called a basidiomycete. So yeasts are examples of single-celled fungi. They don't actually produce these large fruiting bodies or sexual organs, but they are all members of the same kingdom, a kingdom of organisms that we call the fungi.
And now, I know that there are some fungi that have mind-altering aspects to them.
Now, that's true.
Now, how does this play? I mean, one of the things you refer to in the book is the Salem witch trials. Could you explain that connection?
Well, it is an interesting connection. The ergot fungus, this is a plant parasite, a thing that grows on rye, produces a whole series of different toxins and also some mind-altering substances. Some of those toxins are able to constrict blood vessels and lead to some terrifying symptoms described as ergotism. But also the ergot fungus produces a natural version of LSD. And it's been suggested actually some years ago that some of the symptoms reported by those supposedly possessed by demons in Salem in Massachusetts were actually due to the consumption of flour, rye flour, that was contaminated with this ergot fungus.
I thought this was so interesting because you say that the weather was such that it would have encouraged the growth of the fungus on the rye at that particular time.
That's right. It's been studied, and it does seem that the weather conditions were just perfect for the proliferation of this organism, this ergot fungus. So the timing seems to be just right.
Well, you know, staying in the past, but let's move up to the 1840s and the famous potato famine in Ireland. I mean, it wiped out a generation. Now, what caused that?
Well, I suppose that was a series of events, really. I mean, British policy at the time perhaps can be faulted. But the Irish population then at nearly 8 million people was astonishingly dependent upon the potato as a source of calories. And perhaps 6 million of those people were really utterly dependent upon the potato. And so when the weather conditions permitted the potato blight fungus to really ravage the potato crops, this was just devastating, and at least 1 million people died. We got 1 million immigrants to this country, of course. And then even today's population in Ireland is probably about half what it was at its peak in the 19th century.
Huh. Well, let's talk a bit about what's on our plates, that portobello mushroom, the wild mushrooms also that we're seeing. What is the mycologist's take on the new popularity of these?
Well, a recent study published by the USDA suggested that consumers now are eating on average an astonishing 4.5 pounds of store-bought mushrooms each year, which is really interesting. I mean, the mushroom growing industry is very, very valuable right now. I'm quite concerned, though, about trends in picking mushrooms from the wild, and probably part company with other mycologists in suggesting that national forests need to be protected from over-mushrooming, just as our fisheries are protected from overfishing. So this doesn't make me very popular with those that really like to collect mushrooms in the woods, and I'm guilty of that activity myself. I think about collecting birds' eggs. This was once seen as an innocuous hobby. But I'm becoming persuaded that mushrooming can be just as damaging to the environment. One thing that's important when we think about mushrooms that we collect for our table is that they form these intimate relationships with the roots of forest trees and other plants. And so the loss of a fungus can also have a tremendous impact upon the plant species that it associates with.
So it's a symbiotic relationship.
It's a symbiotic relationship, a mutualism, and it's referred to as a mycorrhizal relationship when we have a fungus consorting with plant roots.
Well, Nicholas Money, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Nicholas Money is an expert on the mechanisms of fungal growth and development. He's author of Mr. Bloomfield's Orchard, The Mysterious World of Mushrooms, Moles, and Mycologists. Now, he came to us from the studios of WMUB at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Well, I've got a recipe for you, and it's with cultivated mushrooms. Take a look at portobello steaks with holy oil. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Chef Jerry Traunfeld does fabulous things with herbs. Now, he's chef of Washington State's Herb Farm Restaurant. This is a place where you wait 6 months for a reservation. And he is the author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. Jerry, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be back.
Well, let me tell you what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about lovage. First of all, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And secondly, what is lovage?
Well, you are pronouncing it correctly. That's how I say it, lovage. And lovage is an herb that really needs to be rediscovered. It's an herb that has a flavor kind of like super celery. It's like as if you took celery and you concentrated the flavor 10 times and put it back into the leaves. And it's an herb that really has quite a culinary history. If you look at old cookbooks, I mean, if you go back to the 4th century and look at Apicius's cookbooks, he was a great, you know, Roman cookbook author, mm-hmm. You see that lovage shows up in many, many recipes. And it was used a lot in medieval cooking, but it sort of disappeared from our shelves and our gardens. And you might be able to find it in a farmer's market nowadays, but you really, if you want to use lovage, you have to grow it yourself.
I'm just a little confused. Are you talking about the leaf of a plant?
Uh-huh. Right, yes.
Not the stalk or anything like that.
Well, you can use the stalk and you can use the seeds, but the part of the lovage that I cook with the most are the leaves.
Okay.
And it's a really easy plant to grow. I mean, that's the good news. I mean, this is one plant that you really can't kill. I don't care what kind of gardener you are. And it's a perennial, so you plant it in your garden once and it comes back every year, bigger and bigger, and it's in the parsley family, and it grows really, really fast.
Well, okay, but now I want to know exactly how to use it.
Okay. Well, the first thing to keep in mind with lovage is that you really should only use the young leaves, because once they get older, they'll start turning kind of yellowish and get tough, and they get very bitter. So use the young leaves, and I like to use it as a flavoring. It's very, very strong. I like to use it in many things. One of my favorites is with greens like spinach or chard. If I'm just sautéing some spinach, I'll add a couple of tablespoons of the leaves, very roughly chopped. I also like, I know another great use for it. You talked about whether you use the leaves or the stems. The stems are hollow. And if you're having a Sunday brunch and you're serving Bloody Marys and you have lovage in your garden,
mm-hmm.
You just cut the stems. You can cut them, you know, like 4 or 5 inches long and use them as drinking straws. And every time you take a sip of this Bloody Mary, it gets infused with a wonderful celery flavor. It's also good in salads. If you think of, you know, Waldorf salad with apples and walnuts, I make a salad with apples and walnuts and watercress and lovage, and it gives you that great celery flavor that complements those other ingredients. And lovage, my favorite thing is to use it with seafood, and it's great with fish, but I think it's really fantastic with mussels or clams.
So how do you actually use it in a mussel or a clam recipe?
Okay, well, I've got this recipe that is so easy, and it's for steamed mussels with lovage. So what I do is I take about 2 pounds of mussels, and of course you clean them and pull the beards off. And you just put them in a big skillet. You add about 1/2 cup of white wine, a couple of tablespoons of shallots, a couple of really nice ripe tomatoes that are chopped up. If you don't have good tomatoes, you can sometimes get cherry tomatoes that are decent. So those will work as well. And 2 tablespoons of lovage leaves. And you chop it just very coarsely. And about 3 tablespoons of either butter or really nice olive oil. And you just cover it. And you cook it till the mussels all open. And then I usually like to cook it another minute or two to make sure the mussels are really cooked through. And that's it. You just dish it up. I sprinkle it with a little bit more lovage on the top. And serve it with some nice crusty bread. It's a fantastic summer meal.
Sounds good to me. Hey, Jerry, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Chef Jerry Traunfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. You can find his recipe for lovage steamed mussels on the website, splendidtable.org. Richard Stoltzman is a clarinetist. Now, that's like saying Emeril Lagasse occasionally cooks. If you know classical music, you know Richard Stoltzman has been called the greatest clarinetist of the century, a classical superstar, and most succinctly, a genius. Now, he is not stuck solely on the Mozart types. He debuts new composers, he loves jazz, he cut his teeth on Benny Goodman. My point, Richard Stoltzman is a man of parts. Well, he has a life away from the clarinet, and that's what brings him to us today. Richard Stoltzman, thanks for talking with us.
That's a little bit much of an intro, but that's I like it.
I'm only quoting.
I know, and my mother would be happy.
So what is this other love in your life?
Pastries.
Really?
Pastries, 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 desserts. No, I just like cooking in the kitchen, and I like to do it when I have the time. And then I'm not under any kind of pressure, which means I could never be a chef. But, you know, it's a little bit like music because you practice a lot, you know, by yourself. And then you go out on the stage and hopefully people clap. And it's kind of the same way. I mean, you make a pastry, you have to do it pretty much by yourself. Pastries are not too much of a, like, all the family get together and let's make a cake. It doesn't work.
Well, did you study?
Yeah, I did. I had a little bit of free time. In London, I was there for a series of concerts at Wigmore Hall, and I was free a lot of time in the daytime. So I went to get some tea at a tea shop, beautiful little place, and had great pastries on the table. It said, if you like our pastries, check out, or no, I didn't say check out, investigate, or whatever they say in English, our school, and which is down the street. I went down the street. Another block, and there was the English version of the Cordon Bleu, and went in and just said, well, you know, I'm here for a few weeks. What would it take to have lessons in the school? And they said, money, actually. And so I paid money, and I went there every day. I was very disciplined. The chefs were great, but the kind of feeling of having to hold your elbow at the correct angle while you're whisking and putting your first finger on the handle of the knife in such a way that it produces the correct balance. I don't know. For me, it just wasn't right, but it did really, literally whet my appetite.
See, it's interesting that a man who deals with an instrument that is about this reed that you pass air through or over, so exacting, so tricky, and yet you found the discipline of the cordon bleu pastry, that very exacting approach to doing pastry, something that, didn't connect right quite.
Well, I didn't need more discipline.
I
had enough of that. And I just wanted to entertain myself. But I wanted to do it well, of course,
mm-hmm.
and with some kind of chance to be innovative. But I didn't want to be drilled. And I guess that's where I parted with the discipline. I mean, my first real experience with a pastry for the public was at the Marlborough Music Festival. Rudolf Serkin was the founding father and guiding spirit of that place, and his wife Irena, they were both from Austria, and his wife Irena was touted to be a tremendous cook, especially in pastries. And one summer they had this kind of international night for all the musicians who come there from China and India and Japan and South America to cook their sort of favorite dishes, and I had found a used copy of a Viennese cookbook and sort of glommed onto Linzertort. And I made this and put it on the table, and people were sort of worried because they told me, you can't make a Linzertort in the domain of Mrs. Serkin. That's her life there. So that you're really going to the edge. But anyway, she took a little bite and tasted it, and she said, it's not bad. Which was enough of a recommendation for Mr. Serkin to tell me that next year I must make Linzertort for all 200 participants. So that was my real initiation by fire or by stove or by oven or something into the pastry thing. And people loved it, and, that kind of got me started. And the next year I also made several cheesecakes, and this young girl, very young, sort of hippie flower child, came over to me at the table I was seated at and knelt down and said, your cheesecake is a cosmic experience, which is nice. She turned out to be my wife, actually.
I'm not surprised. Richard Stoltzman, thank you so much.
Sure.
Richard Stoltzman's latest CD is Richard Stoltzman, Concertos for Clarinet and Orchestra, with the Seattle Symphony Orchestra, Gerard Schwartz conducting, and William Thomas McKinley on the piano. Now, to accompany the music, try Richard's recipe for Linzertort. Maybe it will bring you your true love. Get it at splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly food question. Now, this one's a biggie. What is the single greatest threat to global agriculture? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Super Target, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. Now, the question was, what is the single greatest threat to global agriculture? It's a fungus, the same family of fungi that caused Ireland's potato famine back in the 1840s, and it is not under control yet. Now, this is according to our guest today, fungus expert Nicholas Money. The fungus that struck Ireland 150 years ago is one of 50 different species that all come from a parent organism. Between them, they infect every kind of broad-leafed plant on Earth. Their devastation of food crops worldwide adds up to $3 billion a year. Now, Nicholas Money explains potato breeders are trying to find natural defenses. They're tracking the origins of the fungus back to where the potato originated in Latin America. They figure wild potatoes that evolved alongside the fungus will have strong defenses, and hopefully those can help create resistant potato strains.
Hello.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render.
How'd you get my number?
To the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
What's the best time?
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. Let's see who's up. We've got Phil on the line. Hey, Phil, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Okay, I am going to Japan for a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm going there to teach. Very excited about this. Been wanting to do it for a while.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to have an apartment with other housemates. We'll have a kitchen. But we're only going to have a range top, you know, just burners.
Right.
I won't have an oven. I love to cook, and I thought maybe you could recommend. People keep saying, you know, well, woks are so versatile, maybe just find a cookbook on a wok. But I don't know if maybe I could maybe come up with something else, a good cookbook that will help my situation.
Yeah, so stovetop cooking is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to, how many burners do you have again?
Let's assume two. I don't actually know.
All right. Well, you know, if you're going to do wok, all right, because are you going to be in a big city or are you going to be in a rural area?
I'm going to be about 20 minutes south of Yokohama,
okay,
which is like south of Tokyo,
mm-hmm,
and on the coast.
Okay. Oh, boy. I just...
Yeah.
Oh, I would say you take out for a year. I mean, what you are going to be exposed to. But I hear you. You want to cook. There's something that occurs to me. Let's follow the wok thread for a second. You're going to be surrounded by Asian influences there. But there is an author who has done a whole series of books of cooking in a wok. And, you know, the great thing about a wok is, as you know, you can stew in it. You can steam in it. You can roast in the blessed thing by covering it, you know, like do pot roast, as well as doing the stir fry. And it's a great heat conductor. That's the other thing. And it's cheap. But you, Carpenter, is the author I'm thinking of. He's done things called Hot Wok. He's done something like Pacific Rim. And the thing about it is he uses that wok not just for classic recipes from China, but for rather innovative fusion things that really work. They're dynamite. He tends to lean towards spicy hot flavors.
Okay.
That's one idea. Now, I can't think offhand of a cookbook that is specifically about stovetop cooking. But there is this great basic out there that's going to have a lot about it, and that is How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because what I like about Mark is he streamlines recipes, and yet he doesn't sacrifice any of the flavor.
Okay.
And there's going to be a lot in there about that kind of thing. So there's a couple of ideas.
One other quick thing, is there anything that you could recommend to take with me, a kind of culinary secret weapon that I wouldn't find there? My luggage space is going to be pretty limited. I was thinking along the lines of Chinese, you know, five spice powder, but I can certainly get those kind of things there.
Yeah, those kind of things, and you're going to find things there you maybe never dreamed of that you're going to want to play with. Well, you don't have the space, but I'm thinking olive oil.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's the basic, and boy, you're not going to find it there. Or if you do, you will pay more money.
Oh, that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, olive oil. And you know what? If you like hot food, Mexican chilies, dried chilies.
Okay.
Because you'll find chilies there, but they're going to be very hot and they're going to be Asian.
Sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks, Lynn.
Have a great year.
I will. Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Joanne calling. Joanne, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. We have a family debate going on here around our dinner table, and I'm wondering if you could comment on all the different varieties of greens and herbs that are available at the market now, just in terms of, you know, healthy choices for salads.
You mean the debate is...
Well, the debate is iceberg versus something that you know.
You know, there's a famous restaurant critic who once said that iceberg is the only salad that you can dress tonight, and whatever's left over, you can rinse off the dressing and can use it tomorrow.
Oh, hmm.
Yeah. So that, but iceberg is not a nutritious choice. Great crunch, but that's about it.
Right.
So the debate is iceberg versus what else?
Yeah.
All right. Well, first of all, think in terms of greens that have real character. I mean, to me, is this for salad? Is this
what
we're talking?
Uh-huh.
Okay. First of all, think about tart greens and mellow greens together. Like, for instance, bib lettuce with curly endive. That combination, dynamite combination. Leaf lettuce is your neutral backdrop. It's like the basic black dress, and then you accessorize it. And I'm not a fan of arugula. I know this will shock a lot of people because I'm Italian and all that, but most of the arugula we get is overgrown and medicinal. But what I am a great fan of is things like sorrel, which you're going to find in the market, and dandelion greens. They're big ones and also very tiny ones sometimes. And also pea tops. You know, occasionally, depending on where you live, you're going to find the top of the pea plant. Those leaves are incredible. All of this stuff is packed with nutrition. Oh, romaine, another neutral, basic black dress with a little more character. But then you can throw things in. But you know the other thing that nobody does that's great fun to do? Is to grill your salad. Yeah, now think about this for a minute. You go out and you get a head of, let's say, bib lettuce. You get a head of curly endive. You get anything, you know, this is how you decide what you're going to use. When you're in the market, you break off a little teeny bit of the leaf and you put it in your mouth. And if you like the taste, you know you're going to like the green. That's basic. If you get into a fancy store, you'll find things like oak leaf lettuce, which looks exactly like an oak leaf, and it has a real green, intense flavor, but it's not bitter. And so you wash those. You turn them upside down in a big sink of water. You let them sit there. You swish them around. You drain them completely, okay? You roll them up in paper towel. You trim off anything at the end where they all meet that looks dirty. And then you heat a stovetop griddle or your grill. You brush them lightly with olive oil and salt and pepper, and you slowly grill them until they're still raw on the inside and they're nice and brown and crusty on the outside. And you eat that with balsamic vinegar, and you have died and gone to heaven.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
And that will convert the iceberg lettuce contingent.
<What? Okay. laughs> Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Bye now.
Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. This idea of doing our own packaged greens, great. Do it once a week. Everything's ready. You have salad whenever you want it. We've got Roy calling. Roy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you, Lynn?
I'm good.
I was in Italy a little over a year ago, and there was a before-dinner non-alcoholic drink called Aperi. A-P-E-R-I.
Uh-huh.
Tastes a little like Campari.
Bitter, kind of.
Yeah, but red and bitter, sort of a current flavor to it. And I've never been able to find it over here, and I've gone on the internet and not been able to locate it. I'd love to be able to purchase it here.
I don't think I've ever had it. I mean, I can think of what Campari tastes like, mm-hmm. which is that bitter, slightly fruity, but kind of bitter quinine-like
right.
bitterness,
right.
the what kind of thing you get from unsweetened tonic water.
Yeah.
And this is a non-alcoholic version.
Right.
Yeah. Are you sure? You sure you weren't drinking something called bitters? There's a whole family of them.
Well, possibly. Is it a sort of a deep red in color like Campari?
Well, they can be a lot of things. Often they're taken even after a meal to help digestion.
Uh-huh.
And they don't often taste alcoholic. And they have a bitter undertone. And they can be very herbal. They can be really fruity. It could be one of those. I mean, there's a ton of them. There's Fernet, which is one of the old ones. And every area of Italy has a bitter that they make.
I see.
Boy, but what you're talking about, I have to tell you very honestly, I don't know it.
Now, where would I find these bitters? Maybe I'll try that as an alternative.
I would say if you go on to Gambero Rosso, G-A-M-B-E-R-O, and then R-O-S-S-O, is a website that has a lot of information on Italian alcoholic products. It's an Italian food magazine. It's an empire of food. They may have some information on bitters. Anybody that specializes in Italian wines is going to have information on bitters.
Okay.
Yeah. So there you may find a pair. It's called a Peri, right?
Yes.
There. The other thing is, I wonder, what if you were to take some quinine water, some black currant juice, lots of lemon or lime, and put that over ice? It's not the same thing, but boy, it could be really close.
Yeah, that sounds great.
I think that could be a dynamite drink.
Okay.
And no alcohol is necessary.
Right.
Try it.
Sounds good.
In fact, I like the idea so much, I think I may try it too.
Yeah, I will try it.
Hey, good luck. Sorry,
okay,
I couldn't give you a specific.
That's okay. Thank you.
Take care.
All right.
There's this whole tradition in Italy of drinking bitters after a meal, where, for instance, the French might take a cognac. In Italy, when you're sitting around the family table, out come the bitters. Every area will have its special kind. And these are usually alcohol-based. They're very herbal or fruity, and their origin is medicinal. They were used to clear the system, to help you digest, to balance any illness in your system or any imbalance in your system. And you take little glasses of them. Some people absolutely love them. Some people can't abide them. As I said to Roy, one of the most famous ones is Fernet, and it comes in a couple of different flavors. But if you go into any store that specializes in Italian wines and you ask them if they carry bitters, you're going to find a variety of them. So think about bitters. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Kim is on the line. So, Kim, what is the pressing issue? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. It's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
I have a recipe that calls for fresh mozzarella.
Ooh, yeah.
And I have never cooked with that before. I was wondering, what do I look for in buying it?
Mm-hmm.
And can you substitute what you buy, you know, in the grocery store to grate on pizza? Could you substitute that in the recipe?
Well, tell me what the recipe is first.
It's called eggplant timbalo with cavatelli. And what it is, it's a baked pasta dish wrapped in eggplant with the mozzarella inside the dish.
Whoa, this sounds good. Well, this is the difference. The stuff that we use to, you know, grate on pizza is essentially contains none of the natural moisture that you find in true mozzarella.
Mm-hmm.
And what mozzarella is, it's this really interesting process where they separate the curds from the whey, the solid from the liquid part of the milk, the way you do with any cheese.
Mm-hmm.
They press almost all the moisture out of it, and then it's shredded. And that shredded curd is added to steaming water. It's just below the boil. And as it starts to melt, you use this long baton and you stretch it as though you were doing taffy.
Mm.
And it's fascinating because there's great art in that.
Mm-hmm.
And after just a few minutes, that's made into a ball. And if the person who's making it really knows what they're doing, what you have is this fresh, milky tasting cheese with this moist, milky center. And there may just be like a hint of sort of tartness, almost the way as though you put rich yogurt into the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you cut into it, it actually lets a little fluid out. And it's so very good. So, and then it's stored in liquid.
Okay.
So when you get this kind of mozzarella, which is very close to the, you know, this is the true stuff, you look for it being sold in little tubs of liquid.
Mm-hmm.
okay, as opposed to the dry one that you grate on pizza. And the fresher it is, the better. But the reality is these days it's often shipped frozen, and then the people who are selling it will defrost it.
Okay.
And that's really not terrible. Mm-hmm. If you live in a big city that has a large Italian population and a lot of Italian restaurants, you might check out in your cheese shops or even call a good Italian restaurant to see if anybody's making it fresh.
Okay.
Where do you live?
I live a little north of Detroit.
Well, you know what? You may have some luck, because the best thing in the whole world is to have this absolutely pristinely fresh.
Mm.
Now, it sounds like in your recipe, what is called for is this cheese, and it's going in sort of the center of this thing?
Yes.
Yeah. It's going to melt. This mozzarella that's in liquid melts into this lovely, stretchy, almost creamy cheese. Mm. The other stuff doesn't have enough moisture in it.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you can't find it, use the stuff you normally would use on pizza.
Okay.
But know that if you find a good one, you've got a treasure.
Oh, great.
And you don't. And by the way, one of the great ways to eat the really great stuff is just on its own.
Mm.
You know, some people don't even bother with tomatoes.
Okay.
So see what you can find in a decent cheese shop, tubs, liquid, or call around to some Italian restaurants and see if they're getting anything fresh.
Okay, thank you so much.
You are welcome. It sounds like a great dish.
I can't wait to try it.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought. Middle age is when broadness of the mind and narrowness of the waist change places. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Now, you can find everything you heard here and so much more on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is the one and only Sally Swift, with help from the gifted Jennifer Russell. Our technical diva is Jennifer Lubke, and our web goddess is Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.